Hey, Ty here. Just wanted to jump in real quick before we start to let you know that this was recorded on Monday night, so we won't be getting into the Phoenix or Denver games until next week with a very special guest. Still plenty to talk about this episode, though, so please enjoy.
Pocket. 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 We deserve this win, man.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to your detritus of midseason senioritis. It's the Purple and Black Pill. Hello, friends. My name's Ty Foster. I have been frustrated and a little disillusioned at this time of year pretty consistently since the early 1990s. Joining me, my best friend, a man who can claim the same, it's Duncan Smith. Hello, Duncan.
Hi, Ty. What, detritus, that's like the stuff at the bottom of your sink or what?
Really good stuff there. Yes, it's detritus is like a backwash. You know, it's like waste, you know, whatever, the remnants. And that's how it feels to me. I don't know about you all out there in radio land, particularly coming from the top of our organizational pecking order. You can definitely sense that some boys are tired out there in King's Land.
Yeah, I'm tired. I can only imagine how tired they are.
Absolutely. It's hard, you know, to maintain this 82 game pace. And as you can tell, we keep having to, you know, take injury weeks. I'll tell you what happened this past week actually is a pretty good excuse for once. So the Kings, you know, had kind of a middling stretch. We'll get into the details of that in a second, but I bring it up because they beat the Chicago Bulls in Chicago 123-115, the third game of this 7-game set. And after that happened, apparently a witch from Chicago wind cursed the Sacramento area and created like a 100-year windstorm in Sac, which caused a power line to fall into the high voltage lines right behind my house and burn up, which made it so that I did not have power in my house from Monday until like Friday morning. So I was living in a trailer by my dad's house with my wife and three dogs for most of a week. Did not feel like recording in there. And I was telling Duncan and I were talking about this before we started recording just now, but it was kind of an interesting time for that to happen because that's supposed to be a very consequential week in the NBA calendar, NBA trade deadline. A lot of, you know, stuff was going on. A lot of rumors were flying around. And it kind of ended up being a pretty wet fart anticlimactic deadline anyway. So good luck for us once again, as always.
Yeah, it's funny because I had been like in my clandestine Kings Reddit moments. There had been like a lot of posts about, oh, you know, the Kings are mentioned as having interest in Kyle Kuzma, you know, for the 14th time or whatever. And, oh, now the Kings are interested in PJ Washington. And I just kept commenting on those types of things. Like, it seems like we're going to be connected to all available free agents moving forward forever. So we have to accept that, like, Monty's just does his job. Like, he's a person who does his job. He makes the phone call when he hears that somebody is available. He learns what the demand is for that player, and then he makes an offer, maybe or maybe not. And 99% of the time, it's not going to happen. And the 1% that does happen, like, it seems like it's going to be something that catches us by surprise, since those of what our trades so far that he has done have been, you know, like, I don't think anybody really had us trading Marvin Bagley for Trey Lyles, right? But that's what happened. So, yeah, all of the chit-chat around the Kings and Kings fandom about what Monty was going to do at the deadline, it seems like the most predictable answer was the correct answer, which is like, he's just kicking the tires on people. He's not going to make any moves that change this team substantially unless it's something that obviously improves us in a big way without, you know, completely screwing our salary cap forever. And that just doesn't seem like it was available.
Yeah, I mean, we might as well just dig into trade deadline generally here, but I agree.
Oh, I thought that was a segue. I thought we were intentionally segueing.
No, I mean, that was that your instincts were correct. I am simply managing my own sort of matrix of show information. That's right, scrolling, yeah, in front of my face at all times.
You're doing the Minority Report clear computer thing, yeah, where you push around data.
Mm-hmm. I'm doing stuff physically
you
right
can't
now
see
that
it,
you can't
but he's
see.
Pushing data around.
Yeah, the data's moving. Anyway, I agree with you. And, you know, we've talked about this some on the show already this year, that the likelihood was kind of always going to be that he was not going to like make a big swing, you know, and there was just kind of no reason to allow these press releases that keep getting released through agents or PR or whoever on Reddit and on Twitter and on all the aggregating sites saying, oh, the Kings are interested in PJ Washington. The Kings are interested in, you know, Daniel Gafford. The Kings are interested in whoever, like, or whatever, you know, they're telling us what we want to hear for the most part with that stuff.
And also serving the agent or the GM of the team that's trying to trade somebody, you know, like it costs nobody anything to be like, yep, the Kings picked up the phone and called us. Therefore, they're in the sweepstakes for this player, which may be, you know, hey, we're willing to trade you a protected top 59 protected second round pick for this player because we think that they're contract value is negative, but we would like to have them on our team, so we'll trade you nothing to let you offload their contract. You know, like it doesn't mean anything to be engaging in those talks. In fact, it's like I said, it's just what his job is.
Right. And as far as the way that we consume these things, you know, it reminded me a little bit of something I found myself sort of frustratedly thinking on Twitter this morning as I'm scrolling through seeing like five or six different retweets or responses to the same video of like a guy freaking out after the Super Bowl last night, a Niners fan freaking out and like throwing a 70-inch flat screen TV on the ground and stomping on it and freaking out and storming out. And I'm like, guys, there's like four or five of these every single year for the last, I don't know, however long it's been since flat screens are not that expensive. And they're always fake. They're always engagement bait. And it's for fun, so you're allowed to interact with it. You can. You don't have to feel bad if you do, but you won't get in trouble if you don't. And I feel the same way about a lot of just trade stuff, trade deadline stuff. I get that it's fun. It's a bit like we've talked about busy boxes on the show this season already. It's a little bit of a busy box. It's fun for babies to keep their hands busy and learn about shapes, but it's not really something that like you need to do. And I just found the entertainment value diminishing returns were pretty intense as far as the drip out of that kind of stuff as the season went along. And again, as you kind of read into the likelihood that Monty's just going to do something for the sake of doing something, I was like, you know, this is probably not going to happen. It was anticlimactic, I think, the day of. I was anticipating something small, at least. You know, I was anticipating something for a backup point guard, not even the sexy Tyus Jones ones, but something out there or something for maybe if backup point guard's not a need because, you know, you're going to lock up Keon Ellis, which we'll get to later, or Davion Mitchell's going to start playing well. But, you know, we had needs, obviously, at big. We had could have used an athletic wing. Everybody needs those things. Those things are hard to come by. A lot of people wanted, you know, the Dorian Finney-Smiths or the Royce O'Neals of the world. They wanted to raid the cupboard of the wing rich teams like Brooklyn, but if it's not there, it's not there. And, you know, we keep saying this, and I don't mean to like shame anyone for reacting negatively to not scoring at the trade deadline when other Western contenders did. That sucks. I mean, that is what it is. But this is a limited team that was the way that we've been playing for most of this year. Unfortunately, has been looking a lot like a play-in team. You know, like it's shaping up to be above 500, but not significantly so. The last recent stretch has certainly made it look that way. And to me, in year two of a climb for, you know, trying to become a good team, taking a calculated step back in order to let, you know, Keegan and your other young stars develop and, you know, not overinvest in a major splashy move that is desperate to kind of move the needle right now is sensible to me. It doesn't mean that I feel excited about it. It doesn't mean that on trade deadline day, I was not a little bit bummed because I wanted to get my slop, you know, and that's natural. That's fine. But it also like didn't affect my understanding of this Kings season really at all.
Yeah, it was not a championship or bust season when we started it. There wasn't an obvious championship or bust trade on the table. Royce O'Neal does not do that for you. PJ Washington does not do that for you. That wasn't going to happen. So in the absence of that, I agree. It makes sense to think long-term and invest in the development of Keegan and others, like you said, and you know, maybe try really hard to put the pieces into place to keep Monk for less than what he might make on the open market. You know, like maybe that's part of it is, hey, why are we going out there and messing with the chemistry that we have if we're trying to make an argument to Monk that he should stay here for the culture or whatever. Obviously, it would be great if we somehow pulled a, you know, 2019 Toronto and got a Kawhi Leonard-like player in trade. But what we had to trade basically is Fox, Sabonis, and Murray. And those are the players on our team that have value to other teams. And everybody else is essentially just like neutral value on their contract or negative value on their contract or not a difference maker for another team. So like, why would they trade us anything for that? This is like a long time philosophy of mine, so I've probably said it on this podcast before, but to actually win a championship, you have to do a few different things. You have to draft really well, and the Kings have done that. You know, like De'Aaron Fox, that was a good pick. He obviously has his problems from time to time, but overall, great player. Tyrese Haliburton, that was a great pick. We were able to turn him into an all-star or a guy who should be an all-star in Sabonis. And Keegan Murray seems like he's on track to be a very good pick also. So that's fine. And then you get to this place where you drafted well, you got good players, and you have to get lucky. You just do. You have to pull a rabbit out of your hat for no good reason. Like, it's either Nikola Jokic in the second round, or it's, you know, the salary cap spiked and now we get to sign Kevin Durant as a free agent, even though we shouldn't have any salary cap space, you know, like the Warriors did. Kawhi Leonard falls into your lap, you're Toronto, whatever it may be. Like, these sorts of crazy strokes of luck are what takes a team from being a solid playoff team to championship team generally. Or, you know, it's LeBron and he's from Cleveland. And so he's like, I'm going back to Cleveland. That's something that would just never happen for any other reason other than it was his hometown. And they happened to have the first pick in the draft where the best first pick of all time was available. So we're in a holding pattern. We are. We're waiting on that lucky part. And, you know, you can make your own luck to a certain extent. You can be really good at finding value in the later picks. Like, we're gonna see what Monty's made of in that respect, but there wasn't a, you know, if we just package Kevin Huerter and a first round pick, we're going to get Giannis Antetokounmpo, you know, like, no, you have to pick him 15th and he looks weird for a few years and then he turns into an MVP
for sure. I think that any reasonable observer is going to deep down understand that we do not have the assets to get back the things that a lot of people want in terms of moving the needle. That kind of goes without saying. There were a lot of kind of painful misses. The one that really stung for me was Daniel Gafford to Washington. That's exactly the type of player we need. He played really well against the Kings earlier this year. And he went for basically the package that we sent over the offseason to give Sabonis his early extension, which was Rashawn Holmes and a first round pick and a protected first round pick. You know, that stings. I would like to have Daniel Gafford instead of not Daniel Gafford at this point in the season. That would definitely help us. But it's also not like an emergency, you know, it's just that's not going to take us from a 7 seed to like a 2 seed and change everything about our postseason. It's going to make us better. It's going to make the product more fun, but eyes on the prize. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I mean, to me, when I hear Daniel Gafford for a protected first round pick, I'm like, why? You know, like, that's not going to make us a championship team. And like, a first round pick is a first round pick. But I think that you're right in the sense that I think there's a trend that I've been noticing that NBA teams would rather have a player that has proven that they actually belong in the NBA than some pie in the sky thing. And that is, to me, a big part of the story of why, not just for the Kings, but for this trade deadline generally, people were like, yeah, nothing really happened, because nobody wanted to unload a real NBA player to take on some crazy amount of risk and like, oh, we're going to get a, you know, 2027 first round pick from Golden State. We don't know who's going to be on the team at that point. Maybe it'll be a really high pick. Maybe it won't. Like, there's too much variance in the outcomes. And so people really hold tight to assets like Royce O'Neal or Daniel Gafford or whatever that are ultimately, like, those are not players that can change the destiny of your team so much as they can take a team that is already in a really good place and like plug one single tiny hole in the boat, you know, like if you have a lot of leaks, it's not going to work. But if you need one very specific thing, then you might be, you know, if you're Denver, yeah, you know, maybe Royce O'Neal is the guy.
That's a perfect example because Denver made that move a few years ago when they traded for Aaron Gordon. That was it. That was the catalyst. That was the thing that tied the whole room together. That's the last step that you always need. And then you need to get lucky on top of that to win the title, right?
Yeah. And Aaron Gordon, like, I agree that is what they did. But also, Aaron Gordon was at one point, I don't know what he was, maybe like a seventh pick or something. I think he was a top 10 pick. Fourth. Yeah, there you go. And somebody that was considered maybe a future franchise player for Orlando. And then he revealed himself to be a talented player, a useful player, but not like somebody that you want to be your A number one. And so that just shows how few players there are that really actually can change your destiny. You know, There are seven of them that are good enough to be the best player on a championship team in the NBA. And then, you know, maybe another 40 or 50 who can swing the odds, and everybody else is just kind of like, if you can put them in the very specific role that they need to be in and you have absolutely everything else covered, then they're great.
Speaking of players who can swing the odds, we should not talk about this deadline for the Kings as though no moves took place. They did, of course, make one big one, trading Kings legend Dimitrios Agravanis, the draft rights to Dimitrios Agravanis, for hopefully one day friend of the show, Robin Lopez, and number one Sacramento Kings trade acquisition target cash considerations. They then waived Robin Lopez, which that one really hurt me because I was really looking forward to some Slamson sumo type stuff. Robin Lopez is just a walking gimmick. I mean, he's just a tremendous, he's walking entertainment value. The Lopez's are like the NBA's Kelsey brothers. Like, we love to look at them. We love to see them. We love to see them doing stuff, whatever. Anyway, that was a classic kind of Kings Monty McNair move. You know, you move some numbers around on a spreadsheet and something happens for the boss and they're happy about that. And the fans are like, what? And it doesn't matter.
Let's think of it this way. Like, let's just pretend that they made $1 million on that deal and that $1 million that they made was what Monty owed to Vivek for Vivek allowing him to fire Luke Walton and hire a third coach that was on the payroll at the same time, I believe. Let's just pretend that that's what the money's for. And when you think of it that way, it feels a lot better than like, oh, why are they doing nothing but adding money to the billionaire owners' pockets? Like, ultimately, you do have to think about the marginal moves that can make a big impact on your team.
It was a bummer. Obviously, we had to all cope with the loss of Robin Lopez, Sacramento legend Robin Lopez. By the way, shortly after he was traded and it was announced that he would be not staying with the Kings, Chase at Chase Everett, shout out Chase, he's a homie on Twitter, tweeted at him, thanks for all the memories in Sacramento, Kings legend, once a King, always a King. Because Robin Lopez had tweeted, I enjoyed being teammates with Patrick Beverley for all of 1 hour and 45 minutes. I'll never forget those times. Hashtag indelible. Chase then thanks him for his being a Kings legend. Robin Lopez tweets, I just hope it's enough to get my number in the Raptors. I hope I left a legacy there. Great example of Robin Lopez being the man. Also, other friend of the show, Chris Yang. I don't know how he did this. I'm going to have to talk to him about this, but he somehow came up with a Robin Lopez Sacramento Kings jersey because he like said he was going to. He like joked that he was going to wear one to the game and then he fucking did it somehow. He probably like knows someone in the organization who can like stitch him one by hand somehow, knowing Chris. But yeah, that was another, you know, heavy loss. However, so we're sad. Obviously, we're sad to lose Robin. Come to find out, the reason that we needed that roster spot, that full adult NBA player roster spot, was because Keon Ellis has been guaranteed. He's been given a 3-year deal. That seemed timing wise to be very procedural. It seemed to me that he was running up against some kind of eligibility maximum or something like that. And I think that's probably why he hadn't been playing, because he was back immediately in the rotation, like right after signing that contract. Huge congrats to Keon. I have really enjoyed watching Kings players over the years go from two-way to working their way up into the league. Keon has a real special place in my heart. So I was very happy about this news.
Yeah, I agree. Just great to see a player who is fully committed and, you know, he does nothing other than what he's asked to do, get the payday and, you know, just the psychic relief, I would imagine, of knowing like, okay, no matter what happens for the next few years, I have this opportunity that is not going to be taken away if, you know, there's a trade and I get pushed back down the pecking order. I think that he was bumping up against the thing where you're only allowed to have a two-way player dress for 60 games, is what I read. So he had, even if he didn't play in those games, he had reached the maximum amount of times that he could be on the active roster.
Yeah, it's this has been a kind of a frustrating thing throughout the course of the year for me, in that Keon isn't like playing a little more. He and Alex Len have both been kind of like yanked around in and out of the lineup quite a bit. I would imagine Mike Brown just wants to see what he has, views the regular season as a little bit of a laboratory and is experimenting. But to me, I think we're pretty clearly past the point of Alex Len being a superior backup center to JaVale McGee. I would like to think that goes without saying. Even if Alex Len is having one of his stone hands games, it's a lot better than the adventure of JaVale McGee on defense, but on offense as well. It's just I have reached the limit of the irony enjoyment of JaVale McGee. We're now at the point in the season where I'm like, I really need to see a guy who fucks up less. But, you know, Keon gives us pretty good size, really, really good defense, and, you know, decent penetration and pretty good shooting out of the backup point guard position at that price. That's fantastic. If we feel that we need to move on from Davion this offseason, which would be understandable, Keon, I think, is a very, very good third option and a reasonably solid second option for your point guard. So happy to have someone, as you said earlier, more or less off the scrap heap who appears ready to be an NBA rotation player, even if it's still a bit of a developmental project.
Yeah, I mean, he's career 39.3% from three right now. You don't notice it very much because he doesn't shoot a ton, but we know nothing from Keon other than him actually being pretty darn efficient from 3-point, which is a big deal for the position that he's in, where even if he is technically the point guard, he's probably going to be playing off of Monk or Fox or Sabonis.
So we've been procrastinating a little bit on the main topic of the show this week because it's not particularly pleasant. This has been, you know, a pretty middling stretch. We talked about this with Will 2 weeks ago, last time we had an episode. It was a 4-game winning streak that didn't feel very winning streak-ish at that time. Now we're on this 7-game stretch. We just completed the 7-game stretch, finishing up that long East Coast road trip, came home for 2, and then went out to OKC. 3-4 in those, and very much felt like that. Some solid road wins in Indy and Chicago. Ran into a buzzsaw in Cleveland. Nobody's going to be mad about losing to the Cavaliers right now. They're like fucking playing like Bill Russell Celtics. And then, of course, came home and absolutely wet the bed against the world historically terrible Detroit Pistons. Then the next game blew the doors off of the defending champion Denver Nuggets. There's your Kings season right there. Quick home and home, lose to Detroit, destroy Denver. You figure it out. And the main narrative throughout this stretch, aside from, of course, Domantas Sabonis' 5 triple-doubles in 7 tries, giving him 17 on the season, launching him up the record books further and further for triple-doubles. We're not going to belabor the fact that he's not an all-star, but the fact that he's 7th in NBA.com's MVP tracker thing and didn't make the all-star team. Yeah, kind of speaks for itself. But the problem lies not with our Lithuanian lasagna maker, but rather superstar number one favorite first place boy, De'Aaron Fox. Real tough stretch going here. He was already looking pretty disaffected. We talked about this quite a bit in the last episode, even a little bit in the episode before that. Something's not right. I don't know what it is. It's not valuable to speculate on, but something's not right. And to it, in this 7-game stretch, De'Aaron Fox, 20 points per game, 42.5% from the floor, 31.3% from 3, 17 of 31 from the free throw line for 54.8%. That percentage is obviously bad, but the really scary thing there is that there was a 3-game stretch against Cleveland, Detroit, and Denver where he did not hit a free throw. And in 2 of those games against Cleveland and Denver, he did not shoot one. He was 0 for 4 against Detroit. That is beyond concerning. In those games, he had like 12, 15 points or something like that. And like, before I go any further, I just obviously want to qualify this and say, De'Aaron Fox is allowed to have a bad stretch. Like he's not a bad guy. He's not the enemy. We're not against him, but we are very confused. And at this point, I am very concerned because it's not just that he's not playing well. It's that he looks surly. He looks unhappy. He looks like there's something wrong in his life or his relationship to his work or his relationship to his teammates or the organization. I don't know what it is, but he looks like there is something that is limiting him that is, who knows, that is physical or emotional or professional or whatever. Hopefully it's just rest, you know, and these 8 days off coming will help him because it's getting a little dire.
Yeah. Those stats that you gave, you know, 20 points per game and the efficiency stats and the free throws and stuff, they're pretty rough. But when you look at him a little bit more closely, it's so much worse than it sounds, because really all of that statistical output is being propped up by the one Chicago game where mm-hmm. he had 41 points and made 10 of 12 free throws and was 5 of 11 from 3-point and 13 of 24 from the floor. So if you take that game out, and, you know, that's not how averages work. I get it. Like, it needs to be in there. But if you take it out, it's really like 6 out of the last 7 games, he has been pretty abysmal, aside from that Denver win where he only scored 15 points, but he had 10 assists and was playing a very functional role in a style of play that was winning. So no issues there. And I guess, you know, if we're going to talk about the bad stuff, we should talk about the good. He has been on a crazy streak with steals. They've been highlighting that a little bit. But yeah, it still looks a little weird to me. Like you said, it's not just the ball not going in. I can handle anybody having a cold streak. We've seen that from essentially every other player in the Kings starting lineup this season, aside from Sabonis. But Herter and Barnes and Murray have all gone through pretty severe cold streaks shooting. But when the shot making or lack of shot making impacts just your general overall hustle and attention to detail, and he's making weird turnovers, and I agree, it feels to me like something is going on behind the scenes that we're not talking about, or that the organization is not talking about yet, which is fine. Like, they shouldn't throw him under the bus. If there's something that needs to be worked out, it needs to be worked out. But it does kind of make me wonder if the, like, sudden rise in Sabonis's assists and triple doubles and the playmaking that we've seen from him recently was a scheme decision, and if that affected Fox's mentality. You know, if he was basically asked to take a step back in terms of playmaking, I don't know. That's total speculation. It's just it strikes me as possible, because it was pretty clear early in the season that our wings were not shooting very well. You know, Herter and Murray and Barnes, like I mentioned, had those cold streaks, and Barnes was never really inefficient. He just wasn't getting a lot of shots up. And so I think that the style of play shifted a little bit back more to like Sabonis as point center. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder if that has impacted Fox's, you know, desire or his understanding of what his place is on the team or something like that.
That's a very interesting question. That's like the first coherent hypothesis I've heard about this. You know, it's like since this kind of stretch has gotten underway. I think a lot of us, you know, certainly on King's Twitter, are just kind of trying to like put our heads down and get through this, you know, and then hope that it's just that rest or whatever is just going to solve this. Obviously, like, fretting about it doesn't do anything. And it's not like I'm interacting with De'Aaron Fox. What I say doesn't matter and we'll never reach him. But like, I think he's a little intimidating. he's a little prickly or something. He's a little moody, maybe, you know?
Yeah.
And again, good thing overall, I think, you know, pick your poison, whatever. It's your mileage may vary as far as the type of personality you like out of your NBA superstar. I love a moody guy. But in situations like this, where we are not privy to everything that's going on, we don't need to be, we don't want to be. I don't know. I'm not really interested in getting absorbed into any of the narrative details of this. Like, I just like want Fox to be playing well. You know, like, there was part of me for a while that was like, well, he must be hurt, or maybe he's a little sick or something. And if that were the case, they simply would have sat him by now. You know, this whatever it is, he's figuring out on the fly. And, you know, if it's a scheme change, I don't know. I guess that is what it is.
Well, I mean, I don't know that they would have sat him, because I think that getting that second All-NBA appearance would allow him to make a supermax contract. And so I don't think that they're in the position to tell him like, hey, you're not allowed to play, even if you want to play, and you can kind of sort of give us 80%, especially given that our backup point guard situation is not great. Aside from, was that last night or the night before? Oh my God, Davion.
He had like four three-pointers. Yeah.
Yeah. But so I think that it's possible that it's sort of all of these things making a little bit of a gumbo. Like, first of all, I think he is dinged up. We're at the point of the season where that happens to almost all players. They get tired. That's why there is a all-star break. Mm-hmm. Secondly, he's got the new baby. Like, that's no matter what, that's going to put some amount of extra pressure and lack of sleep on him. And then, you know, I think he was shooting at like probably an unsustainably hot level from 3-point, especially earlier in the season. Like, that was crazy. And so what I've noticed is just like, prior to this issue where he looks a little bit unfocused on the court, the 3-point percentage was already kind of regressing to the mean. So I wonder if they didn't look at it and say, hey, 3-point percentage was sort of propping this up. It was making it look more sustainable than it was for Fox to run like a heliocentric type of offense where everybody else is sort of just waiting to catch and shoot a three. And then Sabonis is playing more of like a garbage man role where he's just rebounding and finishing stuff. And let's go back to the thing that worked really well last season where people are flying around Sabonis screens and he's getting a bunch of dribble handoffs and stuff. So I don't know. I haven't looked at that. I should have looked and seen if there was a marked difference in Sabonis's assists from like a month ago or 2 months ago to now. But the eye test says yes.
Yeah.
And maybe it's, you know, only injury. Maybe it's not anything to do with like strategy or scheme or shots going down or whatever. And maybe it's just like, hey, we all know that De'Aaron's got this shoulder issue. So let's get him some help in the form of Sabonis as the primary playmaker. Or maybe it's the other thing and that pisses him off. I mean, it would be weird to speculate about that if we hadn't kind of already seen it before with Halliburton and him ending that Halliburton season looking not the way that he looked when he started it.
Right. And that's kind of the point. And the thing that kind of crystallized my concern about this stretch for Fox was in that OKC game early. So this is a noon game, Super Bowl Sunday, on the road in Oklahoma. That's a tough situation to come out and do well. You know, I get that. All caveats apply there. But he came out and just looked horrible. And he got blown by a couple times, including once by Lou Dort, like effortlessly. And just got pulled like instantly. And I've never seen Mike Brown do that. Maybe I've missed it, but I've never seen Mike Brown do that with De'Aaron Fox before, where it's like, bro, you're just another player. You don't get to do that. You're coming out of the game. Yep. And when that happened, I was like, oh boy. Like, in a way, I was like, okay, I'm glad that Mike Brown is willing to do that with everyone. Everyone is, you know, subject to the same set of strictures in this organization or whatever. That's good to see. But I was also like, I don't want Mike Brown to be having to pull out his number one player because he's not trying on defense. That's crazy. Like, that we need better than that out of him.
Yeah. And it had a really tough consequence, which was that at the end of that game, there was a little bit of a surge where we kept getting it down to like, you know, 6 points, 8 points, like not tied or taking the lead, but just like to a place where we potentially could have won the game. And Fox was in the closing unit and he really didn't have any reason to be. Like, he wasn't playing well. But I think that after having pulled him early, that Mike Brown sort of owed it to him to let him close and see if he could figure it out or something. But, you know, like there were other people that were playing pretty well in that game. You know, like Keon was out there. They kept Davion out there for a long time. Barnes, I don't know if he got hurt or something, but he kind of disappeared. He was schooling Chet early in that game, and then he was not in the closing lineup, and Fox was, and Fox just at no point during that game did it seem like he had it, in spite of some late baskets. It felt like that was like a, you're our franchise player, so we can't bench you during the closing unit. But what you noted earlier about him getting pulled in the first quarter, like 4 minutes into the game or something like that, was part of what made me first have that thought about, oh, I wonder if they're like calling him out a little bit behind the scenes and taking some responsibility from him, because it's hurting other people when he is playing a ball dominant style and not doing the thing that he was doing earlier in the season where he was second or third in scoring and ultra efficient from every part of the floor.
Yeah, it's a bummer. It's a bummer. We're going to leave it there for now. There's not too much to say about this aside from, you know, hope for the best. I hope that Fox is like doing okay. You know, again, I'm loath to speculate on anything, but you know, hopefully everything is fine and a week off will, you know, cure what ails you. But
yeah, everybody sleep in, take the week off of work, tell them that I said that you could. Mm-hmm. Let's all get a break in here.
We're going to wield our authority as podcasters here. We're getting sort of a bigger outsized influence over culture. And I think that this is a great kind of exercise of that. Moving on to the last major topic of the day. This one was amusing and mortifying in equal measure. Matt Barnes is a figure in the Kings organization who did possibly the most predictable thing I've ever seen during this stretch and embarrassed the Kings terribly by, how do you describe this? He accosted a high school child at his kid's basketball game. Let me zoom back. I'm going to explain the whole thing, okay? Because there's some great details in here I really don't want you guys to miss. So Matt Barnes, who does studio analysis for the Kings, has a very, very popular podcast with Steven Jackson called All the Smoke. Talented media figure, up and coming, but a little bit of a liability because he went to a high school basketball game in Southern California between, what are they called, the Crespi something? That's where his son goes, and Harvard Westlake, a famous rich kid school in LA. And, you know, God knows there were probably any number of basketball player sons there. The most interesting detail of this story, and one of the most interesting details I've heard in an NBA story in the last year, is that Derek Fisher coaches Matt Barnes's child's basketball, high school basketball team, which is incredible. If you know anything about like the Temecula scandal, you know, the like Matt Barnes driving super far to go threaten Derek Fisher's life a few years ago. If you don't know about that, Google Matt Barnes, Derek Fisher. It's a hilarious story. And there was something going on in that game that Matt Barnes didn't like. He was shouting at the high school official, which is always a good sign when a parent is doing that. And then I guess he came down and talked to the Harvard Westlake like high school play-by-play commentator and grabbed him by the shoulder and was like trying to fucking tough talk him or something. The kid had this to say. He said, "This guy was on the court mid-game multiple times screaming ridiculous stuff at the refs, and everyone, including myself, was looking at him. We made eye contact, and that was enough for him to come up to me and grip my shoulder with his hand. He said, 'What do you think you're looking at?' And I said, 'You're screaming you're a pussy to the refs mid-game while I'm trying to announce don't touch me.' And then he said, 'I'll slap the shit out of you,' Lance said." So he grabs him, gives him a shake, says, "What are you looking at?" And then the kid's like, "You can't say pussy in a high school arena. Like, that's not, you can't, that's not allowed.
You can't scream that at the referee and expect people not to notice or comment on it in a live stream of a high school basketball game for high school students. Like, what is going to be more interesting to high school students that are watching a live stream of a basketball game than an ex-NBA player screaming at the ref for being a pussy? Like, wow.
I mean, it's just so embarrassing, and again, so sadly predictable, because I get why they made this deal with the devil. Like I said, Matt Barnes is a talented guy. He's a very intelligent analyst. I think he adds a lot to Kings broadcasts. But he does have a certain 1920s villain way about him that just kind of has to come out. He's got like a kind of a villainous mustache.
Yeah, he's got those eyes that I don't know what they do, but certainly it's not good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, he's a huge douchebag. It's crazy that the Kings have gotten away with employing him for as long as they did without him doing something this dumb. He sucks so much. Doesn't matter how good he is at talking in exactly the same way that it didn't matter when it was Grant. Like, yeah, he can talk fast, but he's a massive douchebag and he's only going to bring embarrassment upon the franchise. So sorry that it happened to, although, you know, I'm not sorry. Actually, this is an ideal circumstance, because if there's one thing that like super rich prep school kids are valuable for in our society, it's standing up to like a dumb bully like this, you know, like whoever this kid is, I have no idea who he is. He's rich enough and his parents are powerful enough that he's like, yeah, I can definitely do national media making fun of this NBA player who, you know, is 6'7" and 250 pounds. And yeah, like it's so great that this kid is like, well, my dad's a lawyer, so I'm gonna be fine in this circumstance. Love that.
As far as the Kings go, too, you really, you can't be too upset about this because there's a little guy waiting in the cut by the name of Deuce Mason who is just as good at that job. So
exactly. And as far as I know, zero domestic violence on Deuce's resume. So, wonder who should be picked for that role.
Only problem I've seen with Deuce in recent weeks is his poor, sweet French bulldog lost the functioning of its back legs. And now one of its back legs is working again. Suck on that, Matt Barnes.
Whoa.
Let's hear it for Carlin, Deuce's dog. We love it.
Yeah, three legs is plenty.
Yeah, if he can, you know, I think he's only has partial feeling in one of them. Anyway, I'm not joking about Carlin, Deuce. I love Carlin. We're all, literally, Carlin is like the thing that is keeping this season from completely spiraling out of control, I think, is that we have a positive news topic to focus on to keep our vibes congealed.
Yeah, and why can't we have a dog as a mascot in the way that like college football teams do? Let's get Carlin out there, not to take Slamson's job or anything, but like, let's have a little jacket and courtside seats for Carlin.
Well, and Carlin's got an adorable little wheelchair too. You could do like little chariot races with him and other maybe disabled dogs or something. This shit writes itself. We have a lot of good suggestions for this organization. For number one, don't hire Matt Barnes in the first place.
No domestic violence. Yeah.
None of that. Easy. That one's easy. That one's free too. And from there, you know, we're going to probably require some consultancy fees, but we're going to give you that one for free. And we're going to just give you that with our blessing and say good luck to you because you're going to need it, I think, because you haven't fired him yet. And I find that pretty mystifying.
Have they said nothing?
They've said nothing. I have heard nothing.
Classic.
Yeah. So it's not just De'Aaron. There are several respects in which I'm looking around in the last couple of weeks and being like, I do see some shadows on the walls that are in the shape of Kangs. You know what I'm saying? We're not there, but we're not all the way out of there. Well, that is just about it for us. I will close by saying condolences to all the Niners fans out there. That was an all-time classic nut punch. I have, for many years in my past, been a Niners fan. Nothing against the Niners. It's just after the Kaepernick thing went down, I kind of, you know, it wasn't even like a self-righteous thing. I just naturally lost interest in football. It was always kind of my least favorite of the major sports. And, you know, I'm not all the way invested at all. I'm not even 15% invested at this point. So I feel for you Niners fans. I'm kind of glad I don't feel that anymore because that was just so abysmal. And I feel like if I was really invested, losing to a Mahomes team would be really annoying because he's got that like mega church influencer energy that I just really can't stand.
And then the voice. It's so crazy.
Yeah, well, the voice is actually good because I saw this in a tweet a while ago, but if you close your eyes and listen to Patrick Mahomes talk, he sounds exactly like Kenny Powers. Like, exactly. It's like fucking dead on note for note. It's unbelievable. So he's
got the haircut, too.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he's looking very South Texas, you know. Anyway, all of which is to say, I know we got a lot of Niners love in this community. I'm sorry, that sucks.
Yeah, tough blow, but seems like they're going to be good for a while, so. Maybe they'll be back.
Sure. That's just about it for us. Good luck to everyone. This is the time of year when you really just kind of like count your bruises and hope that you can make it home for the long rest because the team looks like it needs that. That's just about it for us. So long, my friends. Bye-bye.
Peace.
I don't know what's going on, man. You're on top of the world. Every mother wants to get a piece of your ass.